11th. The pioneer country, however, in the recovery of the Asiatic peoples was not China, but Japan. We've outrun our story in telling of China. Hitherto, Japan has played but a small part in this history. Her secluded civilization has not contributed very largely to the general shaping of human destinies. She's received much, but she's given little. The original inhabitants of the Chinese islands were probably a northern people with remote Nordic affinities, the hairy Ainu. But the Japanese proper are of the Mongolian race. Physically, they resemble the Amerindians, and there are many curious resemblances between the prehistoric pottery and so forth of Japan and similar Peruvian products. It's not impossible that they are a backflow from the trans-Pacific drift of the early Heliolithic culture, but they may also have absorbed from the south a Malay and even a Negrito element. Whatever the origin of the Japanese, there can be no doubt that their civilization, their writing, and their literary and artistic traditions are derived from the Chinese. They were emerging from barbarism in the 2nd and 3rd century of the Christian era, and one of their earliest acts as a people outside their own country was an invasion of Korea under a Queen Jingo, who seems to have played a large part in establishing their civilization. Their history is an interesting and romantic one. They developed a feudal system and a tradition of chivalry. Their attacks upon Korea and China are an eastern equivalent of the English wars in France. Japan was first brought into contact with Europe in the 16th century. In 1542, some Portuguese reached it in a Chinese junk, and in 1549, a Jesuit missionary, Francis Xavier, began his teaching there. The Jesuit accounts describe a country greatly devastated by perpetual feudal war. For a time, Japan welcomed European intercourse, and the Christian missionaries made a great number of converts. A certain William Adams of Gillingham in Kent became the most trusted European advisor of the Japanese and showed them how to build big ships. There were voyages in Japanese-built ships to India and Peru. Then arose complicated quarrels between the Spanish Dominicans, the Portuguese Jesuits, and the English and Dutch Protestants, each warning the Japanese against the evil political designs of the others. The Jesuits, in a phase of ascendancy, persecuted and insulted the Buddhists with great acrimony. These troubles interwove with the feudal conflicts of the time. In the end, the Japanese came to the conclusion that the Europeans and their Christianity were an intolerable nuisance, and that Catholic Christianity in particular was a mere cloak for the political dreams of the Pope and the Spanish monarchy, already in possession of the Philippine Islands. There was a great and conclusive persecution of the Christians, and in 1638 Japan, with the exception of one wretched Dutch factory on the minute island of Toshima in the harbour of Nagasaki, was absolutely closed to Europeans and remained closed for over 200 years. The Dutch on Toshima were exposed to almost unendurable indignities. They had no intercourse with any Japanese except the special officials appointed to deal with them. During those 2 centuries, the Japanese remained as completely cut off from the rest of the world as though they lived upon another planet. It was forbidden to build any ship larger than a mere coasting boat. No Japanese could go abroad, and no European enter the country. For 2 centuries, Japan remained outside the main current of history. She lived on in a state of picturesque feudalism, enlivened by blood feuds in which about 5% of the population, the samurai or fighting men, and the nobles and their families tyrannized without restraint over the rest of the population. All common men knelt when a noble passed. To betray the slightest disrespect was to risk being slashed to death by his samurai. The elect classes lived lives of romantic adventure without one redeeming gleam of novelty. They loved, murdered, and pursued fine points of honour, which probably bored the intelligent ones extremely. We can imagine the wretchedness of a curious mind, tormented by the craving for travel and knowledge, cooped up in these islands of empty romance. Meanwhile, the great world outside went on to wider visions and new powers. Strange shipping became more frequent, passing the Japanese headlands. Sometimes ships were wrecked and sailors brought ashore. Through the Dutch settlement at Deshima, their one link with the outer universe, came warnings that Japan was not keeping pace with the power of the Western world. In 1837, a ship sailed into Yedo Bay, flying a strange flag of stripes and stars, and carrying some Japanese sailors she had picked up far adrift in the Pacific. She was driven off by a cannon shot. This flag presently reappeared on other ships. One in 1849 came to demand the liberation of 18 shipwrecked American sailors. Then in 1853 came 4 American warships under Commodore Perry and refused to be driven away. He lay at anchor in forbidden waters and sent messages to the 2 rulers who at that time shared the control of Japan. In 1854 he returned with 10 ships, amazing ships propelled by steam and equipped with big guns, and he made proposals for trade and intercourse that the Japanese had no power to resist. He landed with a guard of 500 men to sign the treaty. Incredulous crowds watched this visitation from the outer world marching through the streets. Russia, Holland and Britain followed in the wake of America. Foreigners entered the country, and conflicts between them and Japanese gentlemen of spirit ensued. A British subject was killed in a street brawl, and a Japanese town was bombarded by the British in 1863. A great nobleman, whose estates commanded the Straits of Shimonoseki, saw fit to fire on foreign vessels, and a second bombardment by a fleet of British, French, Dutch, and American warships destroyed his batteries and scattered his swordsmen. Finally, an Allied squadron in 1865, at anchor off Kyoto, imposed a ratification of the treaties which opened Japan to the world. The humiliation of the Japanese by these events was intense. And it would seem that the salvation of peoples lies largely in such humiliations. With astonishing energy and intelligence, they set themselves to bring their culture and organization up to the level of the European powers. Never in all the history of mankind did a nation make such a stride as Japan then did. In 1866, she was a medieval people, a fantastic caricature of the extremist romantic feudalism. In 1899, hers was a completely westernized people, on a level with the most advanced European powers, and well in advance of Russia. She completely dispelled the persuasion that Asia was in some irrevocable way hopelessly behind Europe. She made all European progress seem sluggish and tentative by comparison. We can't tell here in any detail of Japan's war with China in 1894 to 1895. It demonstrated the extent of her westernization. She had an efficient westernized army and a small but sound fleet. But the significance of her renaissance, though it was appreciated by Britain and the United States, who were already treating her as if she were a European state, wasn't understood by the other great powers engaged in the pursuit of new Indias in Asia. Russia was pushing down through Manchuria to Korea. France was already established far to the south in Tonkin and Annam. Germany was prowling hungrily on the lookout for some settlement. The 3 powers combined to prevent Japan reaping any fruits from the Chinese War, and particularly from establishing herself on the mainland at the points commanding the Japan Sea. She was exhausted by her war with China, and they threatened her with war.